Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the April 10th edition of the County Chronicle. We'll start with the first page stories. Tuscola City Council. Budget presents $5.5 million end balance by David Porter. The Tuscola City Council held a budget workshop Monday before the regular council meeting. City Treasurer Alta Long said the city should end the next fiscal year with $5.5 million in operating and revenue funds despite the $4.5 million in planned capital projects. Long said the balance is considerably less than the city has ended with in recent years, but much higher than it was in 2001 when we had less than $10,000 in our bank account. She said the water fund is temporarily low, but should end up with about $2 million in cash after grants and low-interest loans come in. There are a couple of water projects in the work, including new water mains in Meadowview, that are being funded partly from a state grant and low-interest loan from the state. Half of the loan will be forgiven, and the interest rate is expected to be 1.25 to 1.5%, Long said. It's a pretty good deal for the city. The grant from the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunities is $500,000. The loan is $842,000 over 20 years. The net cost to the city is $486,000, Long said. Still unknown is a pending rate increase from Illinois American Water, which provides water for Tuscola and Arcola. Long said the city will need to do a rate study. The expected increase from IAW is about 19%. We won't know until just before it takes effect, she said. The sewer fund is doing reasonably well, Long said. Long also noted that interest income is up for the city at about $500,000. She said the city is now earning more in interest than it has in recent years. Several of the capital improvement projects are a continuance of several major construction projects started in this fiscal year, including the police department remodel and finishing the new fire station and street shed, which includes new firing range for the police department. Only one tax increment finance, TIF, district remains active. The Amish land TIF is closed out. TIF 1 has expired, and Long said there's enough money left in the account to finish the downtown improvement project. She noted that possible additions to that project include a bandstand and a butterfly habitat. Also in the budget is $50,000 for repairs to the pool house. Long said it probably needs $1 million in repairs. Also in the budget are water meter replacements, sidewalk work, and fire department turnout gear. The city is expected to pass the budget at its next meeting. The council approved another squad car purchase Monday night. After approving one 2024 Dodge Durango, Mayor Dan Kleiss said it makes sense to purchase a second one that is available from Dan Pilsen Auto Center. The net cost is $28,000 after trade-in of two older vehicles. The council also approved $17,000 from Ford of Tuscola for a truck body and utility bed installation for a new water department truck. The city doesn't have the truck yet, but Kleiss said he wanted to lock in the price on the truck add-ons. City Administrator Drew Howell said there's a long lead time on the truck bed as well. Howell noted in his written report that Pilsen offered $18,000 in trade-in for two 2017 Ford Explorers. One has 80,000 miles on it and the other has 103,000. Howell said the new vehicle is available now and new orders are expected to take 12 to 18 months. Also approved was a bid of $928,000 to CNS Companies Incorporated for the Meadowview Water Main Replacement Project. Howell noted the bid was not the lowest received. Groundworks had bid $588,000, which is well below the engineer's estimate. Howell said there was a red flag, and the state required the city to reject the bid over non-compliance issues with the company. The city approved $670,000 to Grunlow Building Incorporated for the Master Meter Station Replacement Project and a bid of $19,900 to Atkinson Construction for roof repairs on the police station. The council also approved the receipt of a $100,000 DCEO grant to help pay for the new fire station. Kleiss noted that Senator Chapin Rose helped secure the grant. In the consent agenda, the city approved a payment of $93,000 to K. Woltman Construction toward the new maintenance building and $172,000 toward the fire station. The council also approved a change order at the fire station in the amount of $7,500. The changes for additional parking spaces and an exterior lighting fixture in lieu of painting an existing fixture. The consent agenda also included a community building rental with alcohol April 20th for Aledo Mendoza for Quinceanera party. The council also approved the fire department roster with several pay grade upgrades due to completion of training. The next article, Arthur Village Board. Approved mini golf funder on trial basis by Ariana Cherry. At the April 1st meeting of the Arthur Village Board, local resident Nolan Lee presented a novel idea that could improve financial support to nonprofit organizations in the community. Lee's vision improves the creative use of a portable mini golf set equipped with LED lighting to be set up at the gazebo parking lot. This attraction is designed to draw in visitors and create a fun and memorable experience while also adding some entertainment to summer evenings. Lee will provide a mini golf set with both 9 and 18 hole games. The LED lighting enhances the visual appeal of the game, making it even more captivating during the evening hours. To complement the mini golf experience, delectable mini melts similar to Dippin' Dot ice cream will be available for purchase, adding to an extra layer of indulgence. Nonprofit groups will provide the staff to work the mini golf and mini melt stands, and the proceeds from the sale will be retained by the participating nonprofit group. This arrangement not only provides nonprofits with a means to raise funds, but also fosters a sense of community and provides something fun for people to do during summer evenings. The board unanimously approved Lee's proposal on a trial basis for the months of May and June, with evening hours from 6 to 9. Nonprofit groups interested in participating in this fundraising opportunity can contact Lee. Other items discussed and voted on were total expenditures in the amount of $37,000 were approved, a proposal from Farnsworth Group to administer the village's source water protection plan in the amount of $1,500 was approved. Approved Grenlow Construction to complete the projects for the clarifier and demo at WWTP in the amount of $381,000. The project was split between two budgets, allowing spending up to $600,000. Grant Corum of Public Works informed the board that Metro is almost finished with their fiber optic project, two alleys and one half of a block, Palmer and Boise Street. The work at the sewer plant is still ongoing. Chief Michael Goodman stated that TNR, Trap and Release, program was run recently since there were students available at the veterinarians. Close to 50 cats have been caught, spayed, and or neutered. Goodman also reported there was some hail damage from the recent storm on the 2017 Ford 150 roof hood, driver's side, and hard bed cover. He also thanked the Rotary Club for paying for half of the cost of purchasing new larger plastic no parking signs for the fireworks event. Chris Helton addressed the board, commenting that he had noticed several areas in town seemed to have significant junk in some residents' yards, and made mention that specific neighborhoods had problems with barking dogs. Chief Goodman commented there might be further action in the future that included raising fines in those certain areas where junk was becoming a problem. Next article, Villa Grove City Council, former alderman to run for mayor. Former alderman Bruce Allen spoke during the public comment section of the April 1st Villa Grove City Council meeting. He announced his intention to run for mayor in the next election. The meeting was moved to April 1st after the council failed to attain a quorum for their March 25th scheduled meeting. Allen also wanted to dispel rumors regarding him and the current mayor, Cassandra Eversole Gunter. He said that during his time as an alderman, he and the mayor didn't always agree, but they always managed to reach decisions in the city's best interests. He also stated that Eversole Gunter had no part in his decision to resign from his position as alderman, instead pointing out that he had to step down because a business he owned at the time, Bud's Auto Parts, made more than $5,000 a year with the city of Villa Grove, a conflict of interest. As a small business owner, he chose to resign rather than lose the business. Finally, he thanked the mayor and council for their work, citing the water plant sale, drainage resolution, and the construction of the new community building as things to be proud of. He also encouraged anyone with an opinion about city business to attend council meetings. People who are on social media complaining should be at the meetings to have their voices heard, said Allen. Administrator Jackie Athey noted she'd been working on budget numbers and asked that the special budget meeting be held at 6 p.m. on April 11th. She also asked that the public hearing regarding the new budget be held at 5:30 p.m. on April 22nd before the regularly scheduled meeting. Athey commented that Emily from Moran Economic Development was putting together a report of demographic statistics to provide more for potential assisted living facility developers. Police Chief Robert Ree then reported that things had been relatively quiet in town. He also noted that as the weather warmed up, he wanted people to be aware of laws against burning within the city limits, and noted that the Villa Grove Fire Department had recently been called out to extinguish a couch fire in a resident's yard. He finally noted that his budget proposal was nearing completion. Recreation Director Bethany Sarovska noted that all spring sports, including baseball, softball, and soccer, are starting their seasons. She also noted that over 100 annual passes, 90 monthly passes, and 6 punch passes had been purchased for usage at the community building, and they were averaging 15 daily passes per day. Finally, she reported that final preparations were being made for opening the concession stands at Henson and Richmond Parks, and that she would be hiring seasonal employees to staff these locations. Mayor Eversole Gunter then brought up the idea of putting vending machines in the community building, and Sarovska agreed to look into it. Finally, Public Works Director Mark McSell reported that the old Richmond Park concession stand has been moved and converted to storage. All ball fields are being prepped for competition, and the restroom should be reopened next week. He also noted that he had reported 120 locations to Illinois American Water Company regarding unfinished work. He said that the city would be conducting spring yard waste cleanup from April 9th to 8th to 19th, and that a date for the annual waste management town cleanup was still under discussion. Mayor Ebersol Gunter said a contract had been signed with South Plains Rodeo to bring their rodeo to Villa Grove again on Friday, August 2nd. She stated the rodeo company has promised to communicate better with the Ag Days leadership team about coordinating their efforts. And finally, she noted that the McCoy subdivision punch list for finishing repair work regarding the water project had been completed. The next first page article, state police arrest Tuscola man on child porn charges out of Tuscola. Illinois State Police, ISP, Division of Criminal Investigations, Zone 5, arrested 30-year-old Jeremy D. Schrock of Tuscola April 3rd on two counts of possession of child pornography, a Class 2 felony, and two counts of dissemination of child pornography, a Class X felony. According to Douglas County records, the state police obtained a warrant for Schrock's electronic accounts and eventually found sexual images depicting an infant and toddler child. Police allege that Schrock was engaged in the marketing of the images. The warrant stemmed from a cyber tip from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, NCMEC, according to state police. The investigation was a collaborative effort between the Illinois Attorney General's Internet Crimes Against Children's Task Force, the Douglas County State's Attorney's Office, and the state police. Schrock will be held in Douglas County Jail until his preliminary hearings at 1:30 p.m. on April 17th. The court previously found Schrock to be a risk if not left in custody because he may further disseminate more images and is unable to be monitored outside of jail. All suspects are considered innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. The Illinois State Police provided the resource for parents to the public to report crimes against children and victims to start their path toward healing and recovery. Anonymous tips of child pornography can also be reported through the NCMEC cyber tip line. And the final first page story, remains of Charles Brown to be buried this month at Humboldt. Electrician's mate, third class Charles Brown, a native of Arcola, who died aboard the USS West Virginia during the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, will have his remains buried at 10 a.m. April 20th in Humboldt Township Cemetery with full military honors. On December 7, 1941, the Imperial Japanese Navy launched a surprise attack on the United States Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, Oahu, Territory of Hawaii. On board the battleship USS West Virginia, which was damaged in the attack, were brothers Harry and Charles Brown of Arcola. Harry survived the attack, but Charles was killed and his remains were considered to be unrecoverable. In March 2021, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency announced that the remains of EM3 Charles Brown had been identified. Charles Brown will be coming home this month. Charles Darling Brown was the son of James Allison Al Brown and Lily Wellbaum Brown of our rural Arcola. The Brown family history in America stretches back eight generations to Lieutenant Richard Brown, who came to the American colonies from Maidstone, Kent, England around 1650 and settled in Southold, Long Island, New York, where he served with the Suffolk County Militia. Seven generations later, Al Brown's father, Charles Dameron Brown, was born to Mahala Brown, the daughter of Solomon and Elizabeth Brown in Jackson County, Ohio in 1842. Charles was raised by his grandparents, Solomon and Elizabeth. In March 1868, Charles Dameron Brown married Philomena Darling of Jackson County, Ohio, and in 1871, Charles and Philomena moved their growing family, including a newborn son, James Allison Brown, to Douglas County, Illinois, where Charles purchased 35 acres of farmland 2 miles southwest of Arcola, where he and Philomena farmed and raised eight children. On November 3, 1894, at the age of 23, James Allison, Al Brown, married Lily Wellbaum and Arthur. Lily was born to Richard Uncle Dick Wellbaum and his wife Oliver Stradler Wellbaum in Greenup in 1874. Shortly after she was born, Lily's family moved to the Cook's Mills area where Richard ran a grocery store out of his home. Sometime before 1914, Al purchased 40 acres of land about a half mile due south of his father's farm near a bend in the Kaskaskia River, and his father purchased an additional 27.5 acres adjacent to the east of Al's land. Their land was bordering on the south by the Douglas-Coles County line. It was there that Al and Lily Brown's 13 children were born: Allie Mae, or Dot, Cleta Flo, Leland Elmer, Frida Philomena, Fred Herschel, and Gladys Olive, Ruby Opal, Ada Charlotte, Lois Pearl, Juanita A., Harry Verde, Charles Darling, and Sylvia Roberta. Charles Darling Brown was born at 12:20 p.m. on the family farm on May 4, 1919, with local physician Dr. George H. Moser in attendance. Charles was the 12th and the youngest boy born to Al and Lily Brown, and was common in working families, the older children helped keep an eye on Charles when he was growing up. In an interview with Eloise Elder Quinley, the daughter of Charles' sister Ada, she said that when Charles was born, her mother, Lily Brown, told Ada that he was hers to look after. It was a responsibility she took very seriously, and she became very close to him. Eloise said her mother said the family always called Charles by the nickname Chai. Eloise is one of only two family members remaining who know Charles, although she's so young she barely remembers him. Another niece, Allison Wright Davis, the daughter of Charles' sister Sylvia Brown Wright, said Charles was a baby and he was a baby boy, and that the rest of the family was always watching over him. The Brown children were educated in rural country schools, which was standard form of education for most children in America in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Because most children had to walk to school at the time, schoolhouses were built to accommodate the population wherever there seemed to be enough children to warrant a school and to keep the distance to the school within just a few miles. Charles Darling Brown received an eighth grade education, a normal education at the time, at a rural school named Columbia, which was located about 1.25 miles west of the Brown farm, just across the county line in Coles County. His teacher was a young woman named Opal Lundy. She later married Arthur Harry. Allison Davis said once the Brown children completed the eighth grade, they went to work on the family farm where everyone is expected and needed to pitch in. Life on the family farm was hard. There was always work to be done and chores to be completed and seasonal farm laborers to organize and seemingly never-ending meals to prepare. Sylvia told her daughter Allison that they would no longer finish with breakfast. They would have to start making lunch to keep everyone fed on time. Charles decided he wanted to join the Navy when he was pretty young, maybe as a way to escape the difficult life on the farm or possibly to see the world. In December 1937, he reported to the Navy recruitment station located at the Mattoon Post Office at 1701 Charleston Avenue in Mattoon to start the application process to join. He returned there on January 10, 1938 for a physical and was accompanied by his father, who was given a form to sign saying he would not at any time request his son's discharge from the Navy. On May 13, 1938, Charles reported to the Navy recruiting station in St. Louis, where he was formally enlisted for four full years in the U.S. Navy as an apprentice seaman. His enlistment papers described him as 19 years old with a ruddy complexion, light brown hair, blue eyes. He was 5'7¾" tall and 125 pounds. Eloise Quinley and Allison Davis both heard the family story growing up when Charles decided he wanted to join the Navy, his father, Al Brown, was encouraged his son, Harry, to go with Charles to keep an eye on him. So on May 13, 1938, Harry Brown also enlisted in the United States Navy. As Charles Darling Brown and as Harry Brown reported for the boot camp in San Diego on May 16, 1838, and on August 28, they were assigned to the USS West Virginia, or the Weavy, as her crew affectionately referred to her. Charles earned several promotions, seaman second class, fireman third class, fireman second class, fireman first class, and advanced to electrician's mate third class on August 16, 1940. On November 26, 1941, he requested a change of rating from electrician's mate third class to machinist mate second class, saying that machinist mate more closely matched the work he'd been doing. On the morning of December 7, 1941, EM-3C Charles Darling Brown and MM-2C Harry Verde Brown were both aboard the USS West Virginia, which was docked in the South Channel side of Ford Island and Pearl Harbor, Oahu, territory of Hawaii, when the Imperial Japanese Army executed a surprise attack on the ships moored in the harbor and the air stations on Oahu. Within minutes, the USS West Virginia had taken two torpedo hits to her port side, and the ship was beginning to list as a third explosion shook the vessel. The USS West Virginia received seven torpedo hits and was struck by two armor-piercing shells in the attack, causing extensive damage and igniting fires throughout the ship. The ship was also rocked by a massive explosion on the USS Arizona, which was moored nearby, shooting burning shrapnel into the West Virginia, and the ship and crew were surrounded by flames burning in the oil which had leaked into the water from the injured ships. In order to prevent the USS West Virginia from capsizing, two of the ship's officers began counter-flooding the measures. As the crew struggled to contain the fires on their ship, the ship began to sink with some of her crew trapped below. It's not known exactly what happened to Charles Brown that morning. The Brown family that lingers with Allison Davies is what Harry was topside while Charles was still below decks getting dressed. when the attack began. Harry was injured but survived, and Charles went missing. About a week after the attack, Al Brown received a telegram from the office of Rear Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Bureau of Investigation, informing him that your son Charles Darling Brown, electrician mate, 3rd class, U.S. Navy, was lost in action on the performance of his duty and in service to his country. Less than a week later, Al received a second telegram dated December 19th from Randall Jacobs, Bureau of Navigation, informing him that later reports indicate your son, Charles Darling Brown, electrician's mate, 3rd class, previously reported as lost, is now reported as a survivor. Both Eloise Quinley and Allison Davis said that their mother didn't really talk too much about what happened to their brother Charles, but knew his death hit them hard. Their mothers were from a generation that kept things to themselves. But pointing out that her mother helped raise Charles, Eloise said she knew her mother really cared for Charles and was very broken up about losing him, as was the entire family. She said the family was devastated when they received the telegram saying Charles had been killed, but they were elated to receive the second telegram saying it was a mistake and that he had survived. And with that bit of good news, the family was able to have a great Christmas that year. Harry had been hospitalized for about a week due to his injuries, post-traumatic stress, and then he was sent stateside to recover. Harry had married a young woman from Seattle, Washington, named Doris Bogenholm in October 1940, and now considered Seattle home. For 2 months, the Brown family anxiously waited for some word from Charles. On February 20, 1942, the co-owner and publisher of the Arcola Record Herald, PA, Lindenmeyer, sent a letter on behalf of the Brown family to Randall Jacobs with the Bureau of Navigation in Washington, D.C., asking for information about the fate of Charles Darling Brown. On February 26, Charles' sister, Allie Dot Brown Floyd, wrote a letter to the Information Bureau asking for information about her brother. Al and Lily Brown soon received word in the form of a letter from Randall Jacobs dated February 27, 1942, in which he stated the Navy Department had been making every effort to locate their son. He also provided an explanation for the second telegram they received mistakenly telling me that their son was a survivor. He went on to say that with the time that had elapsed, no word from Charles had possibility being alive had been entirely abandoned, and the Secretary of the Navy, after considering all the circumstances surrounding his disappearance, has reluctantly forced to hold that your son met his death on December 7, 1941, in the disaster. 106 enlisted men and 2 officers from the USS West Virginia were lost at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Some were killed in the explosion, some were lost to the fire, others were lost below decks when the West Virginia sank. EM3C, Charles Darling Brown's body was never recovered. In May 17, 1942, the USS West Virginia was raised from the waters of Pearl Harbor and moved into dry dock in the first step of a planned effort to repair the ship. The sailors who died on the USS West Virginia and were recovered in December 41, or when the ship was raised in May 1942, were buried in the Halawa Naval Cemetery and Nuama Cemetery on Oahu. Only 36 had been identified. In 1947, their bodies were disinterred, and another attempt was made to identify the unknowns, with 43 identifications made. Those not identified were considered unrecoverable and reinterred. Charles Brown remained unrecovered. With advanced tools and DNA testing available today, identifications once thought impossible became possible, and the Department of POW, Missing Accounting Agency, DPAA, has been working systematically to identify all of the unknown remains of our fallen military. In March 2021, DPAA announced that it identified the remains of EM3C Charles Darling Brown of Arcola. Allison Davis, she said she thinks about all that was lost when Charles Darling Brown died at Pearl Harbor that day. She said the Brown siblings all seemed to have wonderful sense of humor and were very witty, and she wonders if it was true that her Uncle Charles as well. She speculated at a generation of family that was lost because Charles never married or had a family of his own. As for the USS Virginia, in July 1944, after 2.5 years of extensive and permanent repairs and a modernization, the USS Virginia was once again at sea and in the fight. She participated in the largest naval battle of World War II at Leyte and supported the landing of Mindoro, Luzon, Iwo Jima, and Okinawa. On September 2, 1945, as representatives of the Japanese government and Allies forces gathered on the deck of the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay to sign the Japanese instrument of surrender, which would end World War II, the USS West Virginia and her crew sat watching in the harbor, a reminder of the resolve and determination Japan had awakened with Pearl Harbor. We'll move now to the obituaries. Anne Elizabeth Annie Miller Monahan, 83, of Arcola, died at 12:01 a.m. Sunday, April 7, 2024, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital in Mattoon, surrounded by her family. A visitation will be held Thursday, April 11, from 4 to 7 p.m. at St. John's Catholic Church, 210 South Pine Street in Arcola, and the funeral will be held on Friday, April 12, at 10:30 a.m. at St. John's as well. Burial will fall at the Arcola Cemetery, Schrader Funeral Home, 204 North Locust Street, and Arcola is assisting the family with arrangements. Ronald Ron Joseph Wynn, Sr., 76, went to be with his Lord on Monday, March 25, 2024, quite literally surrounded by the family he adored and by whom he was equally adored. A celebration of life gathering will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Saturday, April 13th at the Hillegas Schrader Funeral Home, 705 South Main Street, Tuscola. Online condolences may be shared via hillegasschraderfh.com. Richard William Barrow, 84 of Newman, passed away on Saturday, March 30th at 11:12 p.m. peacefully at home surrounded by his loved ones. Visitation was Saturday, April 6th at the Newman United Methodist Church, and services followed after. Casual wear such as novelty, show car, or Harley-Davidson shirts was requested. There's another article, The Pillar of Justice, The Importance of Jury Duty, by Nathan Burton, Douglas County Circuit Clerk. In the intricate tapestry of the justice system, one thread stands out as both a fundamental right and a civic duty, jury duty. It's a cornerstone of democracy, a principle that ensures fairness and impartiality in the administration of justice. Yet despite its crucial role, jury duty often finds itself relegated to the periphery of public discourse. It's a time to shine a spotlight on the significance of this civic obligation. At its core, jury duty embodies the essence of democracy. It empowers ordinary citizens to participate directly in the legal process, serving as the ultimate safeguards against tyranny and injustice. When individuals from diverse backgrounds and experiences come together to deliberate, they bring a multitude of perspectives to the table, ensuring that no single bias dominates the decision-making process. Moreover, jury duty is a testament to the principle of equality before the law. In the eyes of the law, every citizen, regardless of wealth, status, or influence, has the right to be judged by a jury of their peers. This principle underscores the belief that justice should be blind to external factors and solely based on the merits of the case. Participating in jury duty is not merely a legal obligation, it is also a moral imperative. By serving on a jury, individuals contribute to upholding the rule of law, preserving the fabric of society. They play a direct role in ensuring that justice is served, not just for the accused, but for the victims and the community as a whole. Furthermore, jury duty offers a unique opportunity for civic engagement and education. It provides citizens with a first-hand glimpse into the workings of the legal system, fostering a greater understanding of their rights and responsibilities as members of society. Through deliberation and dialogue, jurors learn to navigate complex legal issues and weigh evidence objectively, a skill set that transcends the courtroom and permeates every aspect of civic life. Despite its significance, jury duty is often met with reluctance and inconvenience. Many view it as an imposition on their time and resources, preferring to avoid the summons altogether. However, this attitude overlooks the profound impact that jury service will have on both individuals and society at large. To address this reluctance, it is imperative to cultivate a culture that celebrates and values jury duty. This begins with an education and outreach efforts aimed at demystifying the jury process and highlighting its importance. Schools, community organizations, and the media all have a role to play in promoting civic literacy and installing a sense of civic responsibility from a young age. The court acknowledges that prospective jurors may face hardships and endeavors to work with them on a case-by-case basis. Efforts are made to address logistical challenges linked to jury duty, including offering compensation and flexible scheduling options. By enhancing accessibility and accommodation for jury service, the court aims to ensure a diverse representation of society in our courtrooms. In conclusion, jury duty is not just a legal obligation. It is a cornerstone of democracy and a vital component of a fair and equitable justice system. By embracing our role as jurors, we affirm our commitment to upholding the principles of equality, impartiality, and justice for all. It is incumbent upon each of us to recognize the importance of jury duty and to fulfill this civic duty with diligence and integrity. After all, the strength of our democracy depends on the active participation of its citizens in the pursuit of justice. And that is all we have time for this week. This is Chris Yerkes saying goodbye and see you again next week.